go out, but somehow I only see you. It's just to get dressed up. 100 pictures you keep to. It's different tonight. You looked in my eyes, and now, girl, you're all that I see. You're closing the space, a smile on your face. I know that you're locked in with me. How does it feel?
Yeah, there's the Kid Laroi kicking off Law Matters for this fortnight. Oh, he's a great talent, isn't he? Internationally famous or what? That song, How Does It Feel? And the Kid Laroi, where did his name come from? Well, he's Camilla Roy. Grew up around the Redfern and Waterloo area of inner city, well, just about inner city on its doorstep anyway, in Sydney. This is the Law Matters program brought to you by the Aboriginal Legal Service of Western Australia. Good to have your company. Shout out to our listeners listening in through 100.9 FM Noongar Radio, nationally through the National Indigenous Radio Service, and in Western Australia, a big shout out to our community radio station 6DBY in Derby and Warringarra Media, right up the top of the state in Kununurra. Coming up this hour, we're going to have a yarn with a really interesting bloke. He's a Jaru and Injibandi man. His name is Dr. Daniel Hunt. He was recently recognised with a prestigious award. He does amazing stuff in healthcare and with our homeless mob, with our mob on the streets. He is just extraordinary. So I'm going to enjoy meeting Dr. Daniel Hunt shortly on the program. Before that, though, we're going to talk about the crisis facing courts in Western Australia. More than 20 courthouses across regional Western Australia closed their doors this week, a move that the government says will continue until the end of August. What does this mean? Well, we're going to find out when we speak to Peter Collins, Director of Legal Services with the Aboriginal Legal Service of Western Australia, right after this. Billy La 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 Langa, wire 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 wire, yeah, one girl at a girl, yeah, Billy La 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 Langa, wire wire.
Food of the country, food of the land, food of the people, food of the country. To the land, and the land talks back, calling out to be heeded. Walk with the people down the old track to the place where sovereignty was never ceded. 40,000 years living off this land, 40,000 years till collecting food from the reps and
walking on the edge, looking down into the water. Willy Willy Garden, how'd you grab my goo?
Food of the country, food of the land, food of the people.
Willy Willy Garden, how'd you grab my goo?
Food of the country, food of the land, food of the people.
I tell you what, how good is it hearing our music in language? That was the Family Shoveller Band, a song called Wirt Wirt, which means food of the country, here on the Law Matters program, proudly brought to you each fortnight by the Aboriginal Legal Service of Western Australia. 16 years on air now and counting. Well, if you're listening in the rest of the country, you will be staggered to find out about our next topic of discussion. And to enlighten us more is Peter Collins, Director of the Aboriginal Legal Service in WA. Pete, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Jodie, and g'day to all your listeners.
Last month, there was an announcement that over 20 courthouses throughout regional Western Australia were set to close due to a lack of security. Before we talk about where it's at, because this all came into effect on the 1st of June, so it's very, very fresh. It's a move that the government says is going to continue until the end of August. What was the backstory to this?
This issue's been brewing for well over 12 months, Jodie, and the background is that for as long as anyone can remember, security for the court and what are called custodial services in court sittings in regional and remote WA, the smaller regional towns and remote Aboriginal communities, has been provided by the police. So the police provide security for magistrates, court staff, court users such as lawyers and people who are appearing in court and witnesses and so on. And they've also provided custodial services. So if somebody's in police custody and they need to be brought to the court, to appear in court, the police do that. As I say, that's been the practice for as long as any of us can remember. However, over the last 12 months or so, the police have been progressively refusing to provide those services, and it culminated in a decision by the police to cease providing those services altogether a couple of months ago.
All right. Now, look, we've talked about the crisis facing WA's justice system for years, with backlogs of people, you know, having to wait ages before they go to court. I'm wanting to know, what is the realistic version now of what people are going to face if they've got court coming up?
Well, what it'll mean is that the only courts that are open are the courts in the big regional towns: Kununurra, Broome, South Hedland, Karratha, Carnarvon, Geraldton, Kalgoorlie, Northam, Albany, Bunbury, Busselton and Mandurah. Every other court across the state is shut. So for Aboriginal people, of about 26 courts which are shut, 23 of those courts, you could safely say that the overwhelming majority of people appearing in those 23 courts which are shut are Aboriginal people. So for practical purposes, that means that if you're an adult and you've got to go to court in Fitzroy Crossing, the situation now will be that instead of going to Fitzroy Crossing, if you're on bail, you've got to make your way to Broome. And then you've got to make your way back from Broome to Fitzroy Crossing. If you're in the Ngunnawarra lands and you live in Blackstone, which is on the border of WA and the NT, you've got to make the 1,500 kilometre trip to Kalgoorlie to appear in court. And then if you're bailed or sentenced and you're not going to jail, you've then got to make your way all the way back to Blackstone. So the impact of all of this will be incredible. I think it's going to be the biggest crisis that has impacted the justice system in Western Australia in living memory. It'll mean people who are on, there'll be delays in the court process, there's no doubt about that. And as you touched upon at the start, there's big delays in the system. It's lurching with people in the system anyway. And to give you a bit of a snapshot about that, we've talked about ALS's custody notification service in the interviews you've had with me in the past. When it first kicked off in 2019, the police told ALS that it could expect about 19,000 calls per year. Recent CNS data indicates that there could be close to 50,000 calls from Aboriginal people in police custody in 2026. Now, nearly all of those calls, in one way, shape or another, result in criminal charges. So there's 50,000 Aboriginal people potentially entering the criminal justice system this year. With these court closures, there'll be delays in cases. People will be on remand for longer periods of time in jails. They'll be on bail for longer periods of time as well, which places them at risk of being apprehended by police for breaching their bail, reoffending on bail, or not coming to court when they're required. People will be on remand and in custody for offending which, when they're dealt with, will never attract a term of imprisonment. The pressure on remand prisons, particularly prisons like Hakea, which is also already suffering from incredible lockdowns and oppressive and inhumane conditions, will get worse. There'll be a greater risk of Aboriginal people dying in custody. The cost to the community will be massive, and victims of crime will face the same issues as accused. Delay, which will impact people's willingness and capacity to give evidence at trials if that's what is required. People will plead guilty because they don't want to be on remand in circumstances where they may have a defence to charges because they want to get it out of the way. Every which way you come at this, it's going to end badly.
It's unfathomable, because if people have a true understanding of life in communities, you're presuming that every community has a car at its ready. Every community can afford to put petrol in that car to perhaps drive 7 or more hours to get to court. I'm sure cars in communities are prioritised for health concerns rather than legal. People don't have licences a lot of the time. It just beggars belief. It doesn't make any sense.
It makes no sense, and you're right. In short, as always, with these sorts of decisions, Aboriginal people are going to bear the brunt of all of it. Now, the other point about it's this. The police have argued that them doing these sorts of roles, court and custodial security, detracts from their capacity to engage in policing on the ground. In other words, if you've got police helping with court, bringing people from the police station to court who are in custody and so on, that means there's less police on the ground. That argument just doesn't withstand critical scrutiny. In fact, it is ludicrous. In recent times, the police have received a huge injection of funding from the state government for things like what's called Operation Heat Shield, the Rapid High Harm Offender Response Teams in regional areas, and the Rapid Apprehension Squad in regional areas. These squads target Aboriginal youth in particular in regional areas relentlessly. And more recently, the government announced $16.7 million for police in the state budget for what's called frontline police optimisation. So the resources for police to undertake frontline policing is, in my view, massive. And it can't be. So what we're facing now is a situation where the attitude of the police appears to be that they're very happy to arrest Aboriginal people, charge them and refuse them bail, but then they've got no responsibility and step back from any involvement in the administration of justice, ensuring that people appear in court and that the court system operates effectively and efficiently. The situation's so bad that in some regional police stations, police would not even push a button to connect an accused person to a video link so they can appear before a court. There's nothing that the police can say to me which will convince me or satisfy me that the approach that they've adopted is in any way justifiable. It is so wrong and so bad and so unbelievable that I'm almost lost for words, and that's pretty rare.
My guest is Peter Collins, Director of Legal Services with the Aboriginal Legal Service of Western Australia, talking about the situation in Western Australia where 26 courts have closed their doors, Pete. The Aboriginal Legal Service has offices throughout the state. Outside of the Perth head office, there are 11 regional offices. And we spoke to Sally Oliver a couple of weeks ago on the program, Pete, who heads up our Kununurra office. And the terms that she put it in logistical terms, it was an absolute nightmare what will happen within the justice system there. But I can't believe that one of the arguments is that it will be, affect policing on the ground. I'm thinking 50,000 contacts through the custody notification service. It doesn't sound like policing on the ground is being affected. It certainly seems that over-policing on the ground is continuing at an extreme rate.
Absolutely. And this is putting it mildly, there's a very healthy police presence on the ground. And on that score, look, the examples, and your listeners will be aware of this, but this goes on. You talked about over-policing. Can I give you a little example? In February this year, a 16-year-old Aboriginal girl in a regional community was charged with receiving stolen property. The stolen property involved a handful of Sour Patch gummy bear lollies. She's charged with receiving stolen lollies which had been given to her by another person after a burglary at a service station. The girl handed herself in at the local police station with a mother and then did a record of interview with police where she told the truth. Rather than giving her a caution or a juvenile justice referral, she's charged, refused bail, spent 24 hours in a police cell before being granted bail by a magistrate. The receiving the stolen gummy bear lollies was later discontinued by the prosecution. Go figure. Where in the world does this sort of policing take place. It is a routine and very regular policing practice in Western Australia and has been going on for many, many years. It needs to stop. However, sorry to keep banging on, but these problems with the shutting of the courts have already kicked in one day in. I was told by the CNS yesterday that someone was arrested in Newman for breaching a bail condition. They were flown by the police aircraft, Polair, to South Hedland to appear in court. Again, go figure. The cost to the community of flying a plane for one person all that way from Newman and Hedland. And guess what? That person, if they got bail, wasn't going to be flown back. They're there. Department of Justice has said they'll try and help repatriate people, but the bus doesn't run every day. Where's the person going to stay? What do you do in places where there's no bus service, of which there are many, as your listeners would be aware? Equally, there was a man arrested in Wollooney yesterday, and he was put on the police plane and flown to Carnarvon. Again, it beggars belief what's going to happen and what is already happening. So my point is, Jody, and you can guess I'm pretty fired up about this, the government needs to step up and make the police do their job. And if that entails taking funding from them in order to facilitate this, so be it. But you can't have the police holding the entire community, and again, the Aboriginal community misses out, to ransom by not doing a job that they've been doing for many, many years, and they're the best placed to do that role. In remote communities where there are multifunction police posts, the police are the only agency on the ground permanently with the resources, the capacity and the expertise to provide this service. They should be doing it. They simply can't walk away and say our job's to arrest and charge people and that's it. That is unconscionable and so wrong on every single level.
The cost blowout of, you know, the examples that you've just given us that have happened in week one of the court closures, the costs are going to far outweigh what it would have cost to put security in the courts.
Correct. And there's no skin off the police nose. They're just doubling down. It highlights, I think, also the incredible power that the police wield in Western Australia. And the unchecked power and the apparent unwillingness of the government to stand up to police and make them do an essential job as part of their service to the community.
Now, look, the Aboriginal Legal Service has a history going back over 50 years of advocating for those whose voice isn't heard, speaking out about injustice, always talking about the importance of access to justice for whoever you are in this country. People's access to justice is going to be denied. I imagine the Aboriginal Legal Service has spoken out to the authorities that need to be spoken to. I'm sure we've done letters to government.
Yes, we have. We've written on the 20th of May to the Premier, the Attorney General and the Police Minister, urging them to get police to do their job, and we haven't had a response yet. So we've had no official response from the government about the situation. And as the hours and days tick by, the situation will only get worse. And if it results in a death in custody, if that's the tragic outcome of what happens here, the government has blood on its hands, and as do police.
So the letter would have been received by government 2 weeks ago. This is a crisis situation. It's not just the Aboriginal Legal Service, you know, shouting from the highest building. Everybody on board, the opposition, different political parties, spokespeople, lay people in the street are kind of going, this is outrageous, that this is just such a second-class legal system operating in Western Australia.
That's correct. And there's, you know, for example, the Aboriginal Family Violence Prevention Legal Services across Western Australia, which predominantly deal with female victims of crime, often FDV. They've come out in support of what we're saying. Likewise, community legal services, legal centres across the state, they're in the same position because they all act for the same cohort of people who are going to suffer enormously as a consequence of these court closures.
They say the courts are going to stay closed until the end of August. Can you see there being any turn around when they see that, hang on, this is actually costing us a lot more than we expected, or they already knew what was going to happen?
You'd expect that there'd be some common sense would prevail at some point, but I'm not always that optimistic, Jodie, and I think there's a distinct possibility that this issue, these court closures, could extend well beyond 3 months.
What message would you have to clients in Western Australia who perhaps don't have as great an understanding of what's actually happening and this initiative? Because I imagine that, you know, our lawyers are going to be copping a bit of flack because people are thinking it's just the A-list not doing their job.
Yeah, that's right. I think what I'd ask of the community is to try, and it's hard, I know, especially for people who are in custody and families with loved ones who are in custody and so on, to try and be patient. The A-list will be there for its clients and the community. We'll be doing our best. Everyone will be trying their hardest to get the best outcomes. It'll be a suboptimal situation, unfortunately. But as I say, people are doing their best. Our lawyers and court officers and staff in our regional offices will be trying their hardest to get the best outcomes for clients. But it's going to be a slow grind, and there's going to be some disappointments along the way, I'm afraid.
Thank you for keeping us up to date on this, Peter Collins. We're not going to stop banging on about it either, because the issue is far too important. It only started on the 1st of June. Those examples that you gave us of what's already happened, it's an absolute disaster. And Western Australia, I think, should be pretty embarrassed when the rest of the country sees how things operate in this state.
Well, especially when you consider that WA's got the highest imprisonment rate for Aboriginal people in the country, and in recent times, the highest rates of Aboriginal deaths in custody. You know, you just ask yourself, where does closing the gap fit in?
Appreciate your time, Peter Collins.
No worries. Thanks, Jodie.
Peter Collins is the Director of Legal Services with the Aboriginal Legal Service of Western Australia. It's an extraordinary situation. But we will definitely be keeping you up to date with this. And hopefully we'll also get a response from government. Let's have a listen to Archie Roach, a song called Spiritual Love.
Don't wanna get mystical. I don't want to. All into
the beautiful sound of Archie Roach and Spiritual Love. This is the Law Matters program brought to you by the Aboriginal Legal Service of Western Australia. Thank you for your company each fortnight. Jodie Hoffman with you in the chair this hour. And, you know, we often talk about, you know, a whole lot of serious stuff on this program, which unfortunately is what we need to talk about if we're going to battle the injustice that face a lot of our First Nations peoples. And you got to remember that it's not just legal issues. Organisations like the Aboriginal Legal Service or Dherbal Yerrigan Health Service or all our services service providers are looking at a holistic approach, because it's not just that somebody needs legal advice. It's not just that they're homeless. There is a whole lot of intertwining and often complex situations that lead to the scenario and the journey that one takes, which is why I'm really looking forward to meeting our next guest, Dr. Daniel Hunt. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Before we start, where are you from? Who's your mob?
Bajaru Nichibundi man. So family's from we're West Australian, obviously, and but I live here on Wajak Noongar Budja.
Our program is national, so tell us about where that country is in Western Australia.
So we're probably, when you think of Ichibundi, we're in the middle of the state, so near like Moora, Mullawar area, and Jaru is up in the Kimberleys.
Some beautiful country there.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So you're a doctor. We'll call you Dr. Dan.
Yep.
And I'm sure that's what people called you when they went to visit you when you were at the Dherbal Yerrigan Health Centre. For our national listeners, Dherbal Yerrigan means the Swan River here in WA, a very significant piece of land in Perth. Tell us about how you got into medicine.
Well, I really had no idea what I wanted to do when I finished high school. And, you know, my mum was an Aboriginal health worker at then Perth Aboriginal Medical Service, now Dherbal Yerrigan Health Services. So that's one of our Aboriginal community-controlled healthcare organisations, and it's been doing that for over 50 years in Perth. And Mum sort of just listed off a heap of professions, and the last one she said was doctor, and that sort of stuck with me. And, you know, I'd spent my childhood going in and out of the Aboriginal Medical Service, and I thought it was a right fit, and it's been a wonderful fit since. So I've just loved every aspect of being a doctor.
I imagine that it was an area that, as you were going through your studies, there wasn't a lot of other First Nations mob doing that as well.
No, there weren't. There's never a large number of us going through. I think there was one other when I was going through med school in my year. But, you know, luckily we do have the Australian Indigenous Doctors Association. That's been going for about 30 years now. And so we get to see each other and work as a collective. And we've also got the Pacific Region Indigenous Doctors Congress, which meets every 2 years. And so that's Indigenous doctors from all basically the Pacific region. And we all get together every 2 years, and it's happening this year in Taiwan.
Ah.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, years ago, the setting up of the Marmuditch Health College by the amazing Joan Winch, which saw a lot of our people coming together from all over the state, sometimes all over the country, to learn to be health workers and then take those skills back to their communities. You work at the Royal Perth Hospital now, so I know that firsthand you see the need that there is health services available for our mob who are far too frequently within hospitals, hey?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there is an increased need for our mob to see healthcare, and it's incredible. I'm a doctor and I find it difficult to navigate, let alone, you know, our patients finding it hard to navigate. And that's the role of some of our healthcare providers, and that's what Aboriginal health practitioners, Aboriginal health workers do really well. So all those people educated by Marmuditch really help our mob navigate how to access healthcare in the community.
My guest on Law Matters is Dr. Daniel Hunt, Jaru and Ninjibundi man, general practitioner, the current national NAIDOC Person of the Year. Congratulations for that.
Thank you.
AMA WA Advocate of the Year for last year, Indigenous Doctor of the Year 2024. And I'm only reading this out because you strike me as a very humble person, and I don't think you're going to blow your own trumpet the way I want people to know what you've done and what you've achieved. And most recently as last week, you were named the award winner in the professions category of the WA Awards. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Tell me what it feels when you get that acknowledgement, because like most of our mob, you don't do things for the accolades. You do it because you care.
It's very nice to receive the awards, and it's very humbling. It's also comes with a lot of, well, not shame, but you know how you know what I mean. You feel a bit funny about getting these awards because, again, I've said this before, the work that I've done and that we all do, we don't do that for individual gain. We do it because all those who have come before us have helped us get there. So we all have people who we look up to and respect and mentors and people who've worked in our fields for years. And, you know, it just, they give you that bump and that uplift to do what you do. So, you know, I look at, well, my mum, Kerry Hunt, she's an Aboriginal health worker who is now a mental health worker for Community Mental Health Service, and she really looks after her patients well. I've got, I look at Nacho, I look at the CEO of Nacho, Dr. Dawn Casey, and the chairperson, Donella Mills. You know, they're strong advocates for our patients and our sector and the healthcare of our nation. And so, you know, we've got those shoulders that we stand on, and that sort of allows us to do the work we do because, you know, people have carved the way. You know, we've got 30 years of having Aboriginal doctors in Australia, and there's no way I could be the Aboriginal doctor I am now without having those doctors 30 years ago paving that way. And also on another topic, we're about to this year have our 1,000th Aboriginal doctor graduate from medical school.
No way. Yeah. Is that in Western Australia?
So it's somewhere in Australia, but this year the Australian Indigenous Doctors Association is having their national conference in Perth, so we'll be celebrating it then.
Oh, how exciting. 1,000. What an incredible milestone.
It's amazing.
Dr. Daniel Hunt is with me in the studio on Law Matters, and let's talk about the work that you do at the Royal Perth Hospital.
Yeah, so at Royal Perth Hospital, I've got the fortunate position of being the clinical lead for the homeless team. So our homeless team, what our job is to is, every day we get a list, and this we work 7 days a week. We get a list of homeless patients, and we visit them a bedside, not to provide the clinical care because they've got their clinical teams looking after them. We provide the kind of care that other services don't in the hospital. So we provide access to a safe discharge or discharge planning that's a bit more kinder to our homeless and street present patients. So that is, you know, whether or not we sort of refer them into a medical respite centre so they get a few more weeks of resting whilst they recover from their illnesses, or we provide them access to other services, or put them in contact with a caseworker to help manage their issues from medical issues to homelessness in the community. And so our job is to sort of navigate a safe, soft discharge for our street present and homeless patients.
Homelessness is a massive issue throughout the country. Going into buildings like a hospital can be a very daunting thing for a lot of people, particularly if staff on the ground don't have a good cultural understanding or ways of working with mob. It can feel very alienating. Can you paint a picture for us, Dr. Hunt, of what issues are facing our people who are homeless? What stories do you hear?
Well, we've got the issues of, you know, accessing services. It's difficult enough to access a service when you've got a job and a house over your head and, you know, access to a vehicle and transport. So, you know, we have those difficulties for our patients. And these are some of the difficulties that are experienced by our patients who access Aboriginal community-controlled healthcare organisations, because sometimes these services are not as culturally safe. Royal Perth, I've been very impressed with. Good. I feel like they have improved. They are doing very well, and they're advocating to improve their cultural safety, and I think they do a wonderful job of it. Particularly as an Aboriginal doctor working there, I feel quite culturally safe.
Good.
And there's a great team. So, you know, we have a large group of Aboriginal health liaison officers within the services who work with our social workers and other services to improve the outcomes and healthcare navigation for Aboriginal patients. It's mainly the navigation and just finding those are sort of the biggest issues, I think, and our patients being aware of what they can and cannot have. So, you know, we're probably not as across all the services that are available, and that's where my team comes in, because my team's made up of absolutely wonderful members of the other services. So rural and homeless healthcare provide their staff. So we've got nurses, peer support workers, case managers, and we've got an admin officer. And those people come with a wealth of experience. And, you know, we get to know, we do have our frequent flyers and we get to know our patients really well. And so really provides us a really great avenue to really support and advocate for them.
What are some of the more prominent health issues that you're working with our homeless?
So most of them are sort of conditions secondary to environmental issues, whether it is being on the street or even areas of overcrowding, you know, a lot of skin infections, abscesses, respiratory and chest infections. Those kind of medical illness, and our patients have an increased frequency of fractures and broken bones and any kind of trauma. So we do have a lot of those. So, you know, those things that do need a little bit of rehabilitation afterwards. But yeah, for the most part, it's probably any issue secondary to environmental issues. So, you know, infections and trauma or accidents.
I imagine you're privy to a lot of stories and yarns that people share with you when they're being looked after by your team. It must be quite emotional sometimes.
Oh, it is. And, you know, it's hard not to put yourself in their shoes and get down sometimes. But, you know, we've got to really focus on what we're doing, and what we're doing is positive and looking after our patients, because our patients, every time they see us, we want to make sure they walk away feeling better or haven't had a good service. But yeah, it is difficult. But, you know, when you do work in health, and probably even, you know, when you work in law, you've got to sort of create that little compartmentalization. But, you know, you still worry and advocate for your patients. And, you know, there's patients I go home and think about at night. But ultimately, as long as we're all doing the what we need for our patients, and they will hopefully walk away better for it.
Dr. Daniel Hunt is with me in the studio. He heads up the homeless team at Royal Perth Hospital, working with our mob. You're a dentist.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
I became a dentist a couple of years after graduating as a doctor.
Yeah.
Just because I thought, maybe I want to become a facial surgeon, and we have to have both those professions to get in. So yeah, it's been a few years since I've done any dental work, but yeah, it is it's an interesting area of healthcare, and it's a much neglected area, and it's something that we could probably all, you know, focus on improving, whether it is the individual brushing our teeth to, you know, a bit more investment from a national point of view into the oral health of the nation.
I guess following Mum through the health profession, she must be pretty proud of you and what you're doing and what you're achieving.
Yeah, I assume so, yeah. You know, some of our mums are very stoic, so yeah, but no, Mum's very proud, and the whole family is. Yeah.
When you know, at the WA Awards last week, when you're talking and networking with other people in the same room who are all being acknowledged for their achievements in various areas, does your work come as a surprise to some of the people you speak to? Because I wasn't aware that there was this team in at Royal Perth Hospital.
Yeah, oh, it does. You know, I you know, for a long time I wasn't aware of the team specifically, and we are a unique team. We're the only team nationally that does inReach, so that is looking after the patients in the hospital. A lot of homeless is focused on the community work, but the community work exists, but we need to complement it with the inReach, and that's what we do. So I'm quite proud of the team, and again, hats off to them, because they come with a great wealth of knowledge and to help service our patients. But yeah, we're the only team in Australia that does something like this.
Can you tell us about some of the highlights of your career to date?
So highlights, you know, one of the things I'm a big advocate for, or have a big interest in, is bloodborne viruses and sexually transmitted infections. I'm privileged to be the chairperson of our WA's Bloodborne Viruses and STI Advisory Committee. And one of the little projects I worked on at Durbel was looking at managing syphilis. And syphilis is a very treatable infection that is currently a communicable disease of national significance. And one of the big issues, it does cause congenital syphilis. So it affects our babies, and our babies can die from this.
Wow.
And whilst I was at Durbel Urogan, I sort of help run the syphilis program, and we did more tests than any other Aboriginal service in the country. Wow. And we were lucky enough to treat 10 or more pregnant women, and thus preventing congenital syphilis. So, you know, when we started that program, from the day we started it to when I left Durbel, we hadn't had a congenital syphilis case, when we'd had one or two in the preceding year. So, you know, syphilis is still at epidemic proportions, and it's still increasing. So we just need to be really aware that it is a... there's no shame in ducking along to your GP and getting a sexual health checkup and getting your STD tests. But yeah, that's one of the things I'm proud of, because there's 10 babies here who otherwise may not be here.
Wow. That is a massive achievement. And yeah, I think hopefully with things like diseases of that nature, the stigma is breaking down, I think, and people are talking about things more. And I guess the take-home point is, don't be shame. Just go and ask, because this is life-saving stuff, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I know that, you know, there's a bit of, you know, we've got a lot of stigma around how we look after our health, but I know that none of us want to be unhealthy.
Yeah.
And it's just about having that comfort and speaking to your staff member. You know, your healthcare providers do maintain confidentiality. You know, we don't talk about these kind of things after, once you leave the room.
Mm-hmm.
Everything stays confidential. The records are as secure as they can be. Everything's electronic. So there's no shame in getting yourself looked after and treated.
Yeah. I'm sure that you're a role model to many people who have met you and witnessed you in action within the health sphere. But who do you look up to?
Well, I've sort of mentioned a few of them, because, yeah, I'm not really, you know, how people are sort of enamoured by celebrities. I'm not. But I do, you know, I'm, again, I mentioned Dawn Casey and, you know, the previous CEO of Nacho, Pat Turner. You know, these fierce, strong advocates for healthcare, and, you know, a bit intimidating sometimes and scary in the best possible way. But, yeah.
Get the job done.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I look at Vicky O'Donnell, who's the chairperson of the Aboriginal Health Council of WA. I look at, you know, even my mother, Kerry Hunt. You know, these are strong, passionate advocates for the people around them and the patients they serve. And so these are the people I look at.
What do you love most about what you do?
I love providing my patient the plan and helping them out. You know, I get the privilege of seeing people at their worst, and that is a privilege. Not many people want to be seen or when they're at their worst or looked after, and I get that privilege to see them and provide an idea and a plan of where, what we should do to help them. So, you know, and that's the biggest take home, and that's the thing I enjoy most, is seeing a patient, providing a plan and helping them fulfil it and look after their general well-being.
And what message, just finally, would you give to mob listening into the program about the importance of keeping their health checked out?
Well, I think it is important. I think, you know, again, I said none of us want to be unhealthy. I think it's important to duck along to your GP, your Aboriginal health practitioner, getting yourself checked out, because, you know, our mob, we are very good at helping out and looking after everyone else, but we're not very good at looking after ourselves individually. And I think we've got to be sometimes just be a little bit more selfish and look after ourselves, because then we can really look after and service each other in our community.
Congratulations on all the great work that you're doing in our community, Dr. Dan Hunt. And great messages, good strong messages for mob listening into the program, because, as you say, no one wants to be unhealthy, but there are more and more ways that we can keep our health in check and keep that stigma away and just go forward and do things that can be life-saving and life-changing. For those who are perhaps at school and thinking, oh, what do I want to do when I leave school? I know that, you know, by your own admission, school wasn't, you know, a high-achieving mark area for you. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. I really didn't know how to study, what to study. And yeah, I did not do great at school, but, you know, I was lucky enough to do a bridging program at the University of Western Australia, which allowed me to get into university and then go on to study medicine with the support of the Aboriginal Learning Centre there, and which is previously called Shenton House. I can't remember the name, what it's called now. But, you know, so most universities have those centres that look after Aboriginal students, and it's best to reach out to them and have a chat. Because I did medicine. Everyone thinks it's very hard, and it is. It's difficult, but it's time-consuming more so. And, you know, if I can do it, anyone can.
Good advice. So, yeah, Dr. Daniel Hunt, thank you for joining us on Law Matters. It's been lovely to meet you. Congratulations on all your achievements. They're extraordinary. And recently, the most recent accolade being named the 2026 Western Australian of the Year in the professions category. Congratulations. Awesome work.
Thank you very much.
We're out of time on Law Matters. Thank you for your company. Thank you to my guest, Dr. Daniel Hunt, Jaru Injabandi man, and working at Royal Perth Hospital, heading up the homeless team. They're doing a great job, and says his favourite part of being a doctor is the interaction with the patients, reassuring them and that we're going to look after them. What a beautiful way to journey through life, helping other people. Thank you also to Peter Collins, Director of Legal Services with the Aboriginal Legal Service of Western Australia. We will be back in another fortnight with you. Until then, take care, look after each other, and we'll take you out on the program today with the beautiful sound of Alashe and a song called Close to You.
You were searching. I was waiting for you to notice me. The way I feel about you, it's like I never love again. You always speak to me with your heart, always pure and kind. I listen to you.
Give you the